finances is a primary focus on relationships and results and a secondary focus on time. Delegation, increasing P&PC. We accomplish all that we do through delegation, either to time or to other people. If we delegate to time, we think efficiency. If we delegate to other people, we think effectiveness. Many people refuse to delegate to other people because they feel it takes too much time and effort and they could do the job better themselves. But effectively delegating to others is perhaps the single most powerful high-leverage activity there is. Transferring responsibility to other skilled and trained people enables you to give your energies to other high-leverage activities. Delegation means growth, both for individuals and for organizations. The late J.C. Penney was quoted as saying that the wisest decision he ever made was to let go after realizing that he couldn't do it all by himself any longer. That decision, made long ago, enabled the development and growth of hundreds of stores and thousands of people. Because delegation involves other people, it is a public victory and could well be included in Habit 4. But because we are focusing here on principles of personal management, and the ability to delegate to others is the main difference between the role of manager and independent producer, I am approaching delegation from the standpoint of your personal managerial skills. A producer does whatever is necessary to accomplish desired results, to get the golden eggs. A parent who washes the dishes, an architect who draws up blueprints, or a secretary who types correspondence is a producer. But when a person sets up and works with and through people and systems to produce golden eggs, that person becomes a manager in the interdependent sense. A parent who delegates washing the dishes to a child is a manager. An architect who heads a team of other architects is a manager. A secretary who supervises other secretaries and office personnel is an office manager. A producer can invest 1 hour of effort and produce 1 unit of results, assuming no loss of efficiency. A manager, on the other hand, can invest 1 hour of effort and produce 10 or 50 or 100 units through effective delegation. Management is essentially moving the fulcrum over, and the key to effective management is delegation. Go for delegation. There are basically two kinds of delegation, go for delegation and stewardship delegation. Go for delegation means go for this, go for that, do this, do that, and tell me when it's done. Most people who are producers have a go for delegation paradigm. Remember the machete wielders in the jungle? They are the producers. They roll up their sleeves and get the job done. If they are given a position of supervision or management, they still think like producers. They don't know how to set up a full delegation so that another person is committed to achieve results. Because they are focused on methods, they become responsible for the results. I was involved in a go-for delegation once when our family went water skiing. My son, who is an excellent skier, was in the water being pulled and I was driving the boat. I handed the camera to Sandra and asked her to take some pictures. At first, I told her to be selective in her picture taking because we didn't have much film left. Then I realized she was unfamiliar with the camera, so I became a little more specific. I told her to be sure to wait until the sun was ahead of the boat and until our son was jumping the wake or making a turn and touching his elbow. But the more I thought about our limited footage and her inexperience with the camera, the more concerned I became. I finally said, "Look, Sandra, just push the button when I tell you. Okay?" And I spent the next few minutes yelling, "Take it. Take it. Don't take it. Don't take it." I was afraid that if I didn't direct her every move every second, it wouldn't be done right. That was true go for delegation, one-on-one supervision of methods. Many people consistently delegate that way. But how much does it really accomplish? And how many people is it possible to supervise or manage when you have to be involved in every move they make? There's a much better way, a more effective way to delegate to other people. And it's based on the paradigm of appreciation of the self-awareness, the imagination, the conscience, and the free will of other people. Stewardship delegation. Stewardship delegation is focused on results instead of methods. It gives people a choice of method and makes them responsible for results. It takes more time in the beginning, but it's time well invested. You can move the fulcrum over, you can increase your leverage, through stewardship delegation. Stewardship delegation involves clear, upfront mutual understanding and commitment regarding expectations in 5 areas. Desired results. Create a clear, mutual understanding of what needs to be accomplished, focusing on what, not how, results, not methods. Spend time. Be patient. Visualize the desired result. Have the person see it, describe it, make out a quality statement of what the results will look like, and by when they will be accomplished. Guidelines. Identify the parameters within which the individual should operate. These should be as few as possible to avoid methods delegation, but should include any formidable restrictions. You wouldn't want a person to think he had considerable latitude as long as he accomplished the objectives, only to violate some long-standing traditional practice or value. That kills initiative and sends people back to the Gopher's creed: just tell me what you want me to do, and I'll do it. If you know the failure paths of the job, identify them. Be honest and open. Tell a person where the quicksand is and where the wild animals are. You don't want to have to reinvent the wheel every day. Let people learn from your mistakes or the mistakes of others. Point out the potential failure paths, what not to do, but don't tell them what to do. Keep the responsibility for results with them, to do whatever is necessary within the guidelines. Resources. Identify the human, financial, technical, or organizational resources the person can draw on to accomplish the desired results. Accountability. Set up the standards of performance that will be used in evaluating the results and the specific times when reporting and evaluation will take place. Consequences. Specify what will happen, both good and bad, as a result of the evaluation. This could include such things as financial rewards, psychic rewards, different job assignments, and natural consequences tied into the overall mission of an organization. Some years ago, I had an interesting experience in delegation with one of my sons. We were having a family meeting, and we had our mission statement up on the wall to make sure our plans were in harmony with our values. Everybody was there. I set up a big blackboard and we wrote down our goals, the key things we wanted to do, and the jobs that flowed out of those goals. Then I asked for volunteers to do the job. "Who wants to pay the mortgage?" I asked. I noticed I was the only one with my hand up. "Who wants to pay for the insurance? The food? The cars?" I seemed to have a real monopoly on the opportunities. "Who wants to feed the new baby?" There was more interest here, but my wife was the only one with the right qualifications for the job. As we went down the list, job by job, it was soon evident that mom and dad had more than 60-hour work weeks. With that paradigm in mind, some of the other jobs took on a more proper perspective. My 7-year-old son, Stephen, volunteered to take care of the yard. Before I actually gave him the job, I began a thorough training process. I wanted him to have a clear picture in his mind of what a well-cared-for yard was like, so I took him next door to our neighbors. "Look, son," I said. "See how our neighbor's yard is green and clean? That's what we're after, green and clean. Now come look at our yard. See the mixed colors? That's not it, that's not green. Green and clean is what we want. Now how you get it green is up to you. You're free to do it any way you want, except paint it. But I'll tell you how I'd do it if it were up to me." "How would you do it, Dad?" "I'd turn on the sprinklers. But you may want to use buckets or a hose. It makes no difference to me. All we care about is that the color is green. Okay? Okay. Now let's talk about clean, son. Clean means no messes around, no paper, strings, bones, sticks, or anything that messes up the place. I'll tell you what let's do. Let's just clean up half the yard right now and look at the difference." So we got out 2 paper sacks and picked up one side of the yard. "Now look at this side. Look at the other side. See the difference? That's called clean." "Wait," he called. "I see some paper behind that bush." "Oh, good. I didn't notice that newspaper back there. You have good eyes, son. Now before you decide whether or not you're going to take the job, let me tell you a few more things. Because when you take the job, I don't do it anymore. It's your job. It's called a stewardship. Stewardship means a job with a trust. I trust you to do the job, to get it done. Now who's going to be your boss?"
"You, Dad?"
"No, not me. You're the boss. You boss yourself. How do you like mom and dad nagging you all the time?"
"I don't."
"We don't like doing it either. It sometimes causes a bad feeling, doesn't it? So you boss yourself. Now, guess who your helper is?"
"Who?"
"I am," I said. "You boss me."
"I do?"
"That's right. But my time to help is limited. Sometimes I'm away. But when I'm here, you tell me how I can help. I'll do anything you want me to do."
"Okay.
Now guess who judges you?"
"Who?"
"You judge yourself."
"I do?"
"That's right. Twice a week the two of us will walk around the yard, and you can show me how it's coming. How are you going to judge?"
"Green and clean."
"Right." I trained him with those 2 words for 2 weeks before I felt he was ready to take the job. Finally, The big day came. Is it a deal, son?
It's a deal.
What's the job?
Green and clean.
What's green? He looked at our yard, which was beginning to look better. Then he pointed next door. That's the color of his yard.
What's clean?
No messes.
Who's the boss?
I am.
Who's your helper?
You are, when you have time.
Who's the judge?
I am. We'll walk around 2 times a week and I can show you how it's coming.
And what will we look for?
Green and clean. At that time I didn't mention an allowance. But I wouldn't hesitate to attach an allowance to such a stewardship.
2 weeks and 2 words. I thought he was ready.
It was Saturday. And he did nothing. Sunday, nothing. Monday, nothing. As I pulled out of the driveway on my way to work on Tuesday, I looked at the yellow, cluttered yard and the hot July sun on its way up. Surely he'll do it today, I thought. I could rationalize Saturday because that was the day we made the agreement. I could rationalize Sunday, Sunday was for other things. But I couldn't rationalize Monday. And now it was Tuesday. Certainly he'd do it today. It was summertime. What else did he have to do? All day I could hardly wait to return home to see what happened. As I rounded the corner, I was met with the same picture I left that morning. And there was my son at the park across the street playing. This was not acceptable. I was upset and disillusioned by his performance after 2 weeks of training and all those commitments. We had a lot of effort, pride, and money invested in the yard and I could see it going down the drain. Besides, my neighbor's yard was manicured and beautiful, and the situation was beginning to get embarrassing. I was ready to go back to Gopher Delegation. Son, you get over here and pick up this garbage right now or else. I knew I could get the golden egg that way. But what about the goose? What would happen to his internal commitment? So I faked a smile and yelled across the street, "Hi, son. How's it going?"
"Fine,"
he returned. "How's the yard coming?" I knew the minute I said it I had broken our agreement. That's not the way we had set up an accounting. That's not what we had agreed. So he felt justified in breaking it, too. "Fine, Dad." I bit my tongue and waited until after dinner. Then I said, "Son, let's do as we agreed. Let's walk around the yard together and you can show me how it's going in your stewardship." As we started out the door, his chin began to quiver. Tears welled up in his eyes and, by the time we got out to the middle of the yard, he was whimpering. "It's so hard, Dad." "What's so hard?" I thought to myself. "You haven't done a single thing." But I knew what was hard, self-management, self-supervision. So I said, "Is there anything I can do to help?"
"Would you, Dad?"
He sniffed. "What was our agreement?"
"You said you'd help me if you had time."
"I have time." So he ran into the house and came back with 2 sacks. He handed me one. "Will you pick that stuff up?" He pointed to the garbage from Saturday night's barbecue. "It makes me sick." So I did. I did exactly what he asked me to do. And that was when he signed the agreement in his heart. It became his yard, his stewardship. He only asked for help 2 or 3 more times that entire summer. He took care of that yard. He kept it greener and cleaner than it had ever been under my stewardship. He even reprimanded his brothers and sisters if they left so much as a gum wrapper on the lawn. Trust is the highest form of human motivation. It brings out the very best in people. But it takes time and patience, and it doesn't preclude the necessity to train and develop people so that their competency can rise to the level of that trust. I am convinced that if stewardship delegation is done correctly, both parties will benefit and ultimately much more work will get done in much less time. I believe that a family that is well organized, whose time has been spent effectively delegating on a one-on-one basis, can organize the work so that everyone can do everything in about an hour a day. But that takes the internal capacity to want to manage, not just to produce. The focus is on effectiveness, not efficiency. Certainly you can pick up that room better than a child, but the key is that you want to empower the child to do it. It takes time. You have to get involved in the training and development. It takes time, but how valuable that time is downstream. It saves you so much in the long run. This approach involves an entirely new paradigm of delegation. In effect, it changes the nature of the relationship. The steward becomes his own boss, governed by a conscience that contains the commitment to agreed upon desired results. But it also releases his creative energies toward doing whatever is necessary in harmony with correct principles to achieve those desired results.
The principles involved in stewardship delegation are correct and applicable to any kind of person or situation. With immature people, you specify fewer desired results and more guidelines, identify more resources, conduct more frequent accountability interviews, and apply more immediate consequences. With more mature people, you have more challenging desired results, fewer guidelines, less frequent accountability, and less measurable but more discernible criteria. Effective delegation is perhaps the best indicator of effective management simply because it is so basic to both personal and organizational growth. The Quadrant 2 Paradigm. The key to effective management of self, or of others through delegation, is not in any technique or tool or extrinsic factor. It is intrinsic, in the Quadrant 2 Paradigm that empowers you to see through the lens of importance rather than urgency. I have included in the appendix an exercise called a Quadrant 2 Day at the Office, which will enable you to see in a business setting how powerfully this paradigm can impact your effectiveness. As you work to develop a Quadrant 2 paradigm, you will increase your ability to organize and execute every week of your life around your deepest priorities, to walk your talk. You will not be dependent on any other person or thing for the effective management of your life. Interestingly, every one of the 7 habits is in Quadrant 2. Everyone deals with fundamentally important things that, if done on a regular basis, would make a tremendous positive difference in our lives. Application suggestions. 1. Identify a Quadrant 2 activity you know has been neglected in your life, one that, if done well, would have a significant impact in your life, either personally or professionally. Write it down and commit to implement it. 2. Draw a time management matrix and try to estimate what percentage of your time you spend in each quadrant. Then log your time for 3 days in 15-minute intervals. How accurate was your estimate? Are you satisfied with the way you spend your time? What do you need to change? 3. Make a list of responsibilities you could delegate and the people you could delegate to or train to be responsible in these areas. Determine what is needed to start the process of delegation or training. 4. Organize your next week. Start by writing down your roles and goals for the week, then transfer the goals to a specific action plan. At the end of the week, evaluate how well your plan translated your deep values and purposes into your daily life and the degree of integrity you were able to maintain to those values and purposes. 5. Commit yourself to start organizing on a weekly basis and set up a regular time to do it. 6. Either convert your current planning tool into a fourth generation tool or secure such a tool. 7. Go through a Quadrant 2 Day at the Office, Appendix B, for a more in-depth understanding of the impact of a Quadrant 2 paradigm. Please refer to Appendix B. On the previous pages is a sample weekly schedule from the 7 Habits Organizer. If you would like samples of these schedules, which you can adapt to your current system, please call 1-800-255-0777 or visit our internet homepage at http://www.franklincovey.com. These schedules are also a feature of Microsoft Schedule Plus with 7 Habits. Part 3. Public. Victory. Paradigms of interdependence. There can be no friendship without confidence, and no confidence without integrity. Samuel Johnson. Before moving into the area of public victory, we should remember that effective interdependence can only be built on a foundation of true independence. Private victory precedes public victory. Algebra comes before calculus. As we look back and survey the terrain to determine where we've been and where we're in relationship to where we're going, we clearly see that we could not have gotten where we are without coming the way we came. There aren't any other roads, there aren't any shortcuts. There's no way to parachute into this terrain. The landscape ahead is covered with the fragments of broken relationships of people who have tried. They've tried to jump into effective relationships without the maturity, the strength of character, to maintain them. But you just can't do it. You simply have to travel the road. You can't be successful with other people if you haven't paid the price of success with yourself. A few years ago when I was giving a seminar on the Oregon coast, a man came up to me and said, "You know, Stephen, I really don't enjoy coming to these seminars." He had my attention. "Look at everyone else here," he continued. "Look at this beautiful coastline and the sea out there and all that's happening. And all I can do is sit and worry about the grilling I'm going to get from my wife tonight on the phone. She gives me the third degree every time I'm away. Where did I eat breakfast? Who else was there? Was I in meetings all morning? When did we stop for lunch? What did I do during lunch? How did I spend the afternoon? What did I do for entertainment in the evening? Who is with me? What did we talk about? And what she really wants to know, but never quite asks, is who she can call to verify everything I tell her. She just nags me and questions everything I do whenever I'm away. It's taken the bloom out of this whole experience. I really don't enjoy it at all. He did look pretty miserable. We talked for a while, and then he made a very interesting comment. I guess she knows all the questions to ask, he said a little sheepishly. It was at a seminar like this that I met her, when I was married to someone else. I considered the implications of his comment and then said, you're kind of into quick fix, aren't you? What do you mean? He replied. Well, you'd like to take a screwdriver and just open up your wife's head and rewire that attitude of hers really fast, wouldn't you? Sure, I'd like her to change, he exclaimed. I don't think it's right for her to constantly grill me like she does. My friend, I said, you can't talk your way out of problems you behave yourself into. We're dealing with a very dramatic and very fundamental paradigm shift here. You may try to lubricate your social interactions with personality techniques and skills, but in the process, you may truncate the vital character base. You can't have the fruits without the roots. It's the principle of sequencing, private victory precedes public victory. Self-mastery and self-discipline are the foundation of good relationships with others. Some people say that you have to like yourself before you can like others. I think that idea has merit, but if you don't know yourself, if you don't control yourself, if you don't have mastery over yourself, it's very hard to like yourself, except in some short-term, psych-up, superficial way. Real self-respect comes from dominion over self, from true independence. And that's the focus of habits 1, 2, and 3. Independence is an achievement. Interdependence is a choice only independent people can make. Unless we are willing to achieve real independence, it's foolish to try to develop human relation skills. We might try. We might even have some degree of success when the sun is shining. But when the difficult times come, and they will, we won't have the foundation to keep things together. The most important ingredient we put into any relationship is not what we say or what we do, but what we are. And if our words and our actions come from superficial human relations techniques, the personality ethic, rather than from our own inner core, the character ethic, others will sense the duplicity. We simply won't be able to create and sustain the foundation necessary for effective interdependence. The techniques and skills that really make a difference in human interaction are the ones that almost naturally flow from a truly independent character. So the place to begin building any relationship is inside ourselves, inside our circle of influence, our own character. As we become independent, proactive, centered in correct principles, value-driven and able to organize and execute around the priorities in our life with integrity, we then can choose to become interdependent, capable of building rich, enduring, highly productive relationships with other people. As we look at the terrain ahead, we see that we're entering a whole new dimension. Interdependence opens up worlds of possibilities for deep, rich, meaningful associations, for geometrically increased productivity, for serving, for contributing, for learning, for growing. But it is also where we feel the greatest pain, the greatest frustration, the greatest roadblocks to happiness and success. And we're very aware of that pain because it is acute. We can often live for years with the chronic pain of our lack of vision, leadership or management in our personal lives. We feel vaguely uneasy and uncomfortable and occasionally take steps to ease the pain, at least for a time. Because the pain is chronic, we get used to it, we learn to live with it. But when we have problems in our interactions with other people, we're very aware of acute pain, it's often intense, and we want it to go away. That's when we try to treat the symptoms with quick fixes and techniques, the band-aids of the personality ethic. We don't understand that the acute pain is an outgrowth of the deeper, chronic problem. And until we stop treating the symptoms and start treating the problem, our efforts will only bring counterproductive results. We will only be successful at obscuring the chronic pain even more. Now, as we think of effective interaction with others, let's go back to our earlier definition of effectiveness. We've said it's the P/PC balance, the fundamental concept in the story of the goose and the golden egg. In an interdependent situation, the golden eggs are the effectiveness, the wonderful synergy, the results created by open communication and positive interaction with others. And to get those eggs on a regular basis, we need to take care of the goose. We need to create and care for the relationships that make those results realities. So before we descend from our point of reconnaissance and get into habits 4, 5, and 6, I would like to introduce what I believe to be a very powerful metaphor in describing relationships and in defining the P/PC balance in an interdependent reality. The emotional bank account. We all know what a financial bank account is. We make deposits into it and build up a reserve from which we can make withdrawals when we need to. An emotional bank account is a metaphor that describes the amount of trust that's been built up in a relationship. It's the feeling of safeness you have with another human being. If I make deposits into an emotional bank account with you through courtesy, kindness, honesty, and keeping my commitments to you, I build up a reserve. Your trust toward me becomes higher, and I can call upon that trust many times if I need to. I can even make mistakes, and that trust level, that emotional reserve, will compensate for it. My communication may not be clear, but you'll get my meaning anyway. You won't make me an offender for a word. When the trust account is high, communication is easy, instant, and effective. But if I have a habit of showing discourtesy, disrespect, cutting you off, overreacting, ignoring you, becoming arbitrary, betraying your trust, threatening you, or playing little tin god in your life, eventually my emotional bank account is overdrawn. The trust level gets very low. Then what flexibility do I have? None. I'm walking on minefields. I have to be very careful of everything I say. I measure every word. It's tension city, memo haven. It's protecting my backside, politicking. And many organizations are filled with it. Many families are filled with it. Many marriages are filled with it. If a large reserve of trust is not sustained by continuing deposits, a marriage will deteriorate. Instead of rich, spontaneous understanding and communication, the situation becomes one of accommodation, where two people simply attempt to live independent lifestyles in a fairly respectful and tolerant way. The relationship may further deteriorate to one of hostility and defensiveness. The fight-or-flight response creates verbal battles, slammed doors, refusal to talk, emotional withdrawal and self-pity. It may end up in a cold war at home, sustained only by children, sex, social pressure, or image protection. Or it may end up in open warfare in the courts, where bitter ego-decimating legal battles can be carried on for years as people endlessly confess the sins of a former spouse. And this is in the most intimate, the most potentially rich, joyful, satisfying and productive relationship possible between two people on this earth. The P/PC lighthouse is there. We can either break ourselves against it or we can use it as a guiding light. Our most constant relationships, like marriage, require our most constant deposits. With continuing expectations, old deposits evaporate. If you suddenly run into an old high school friend you haven't seen for years, you can pick up right where you left off because the earlier deposits are still there. But your accounts with the people you interact with on a regular basis require more constant investment. There are sometimes automatic withdrawals in your daily interactions or in their perception of you that you don't even know about. This is especially true with teenagers in the home. Suppose you have a teenage son and your normal conversation is something like, clean your room, button your shirt, turn down the radio, go get a haircut, and don't forget to take out the garbage. Over a period of time, the withdrawals far exceed the deposits. Now, suppose this son is in the process of making some important decisions that will affect the rest of his life. But the trust level is so low and the communication process so closed, mechanical, and unsatisfying that he simply will not be open to your counsel. You may have the wisdom and the knowledge to help him, but because your account is so overdrawn, he will end up making his decisions from a short-range emotional perspective, which may well result in many negative long-range consequences. You need a positive balance to communicate on these tender issues. What do you do? What would happen if you started making deposits into the relationship? Maybe the opportunity comes up to do him a little kindness, to bring home a magazine on skateboarding, if that's his interest, or just to walk up to him when he's working on a project and offer to help. Perhaps you could invite him to go to a movie with you or take him out for some ice cream. Probably the most important deposit you could make would be just to listen, without judging or preaching or reading your own autobiography into what he says. Just listen and seek to understand. Let him feel your concern for him, your acceptance of him as a person. He may not respond at first. He may even be suspicious. What's dad up to now? What technique is mom trying on me this time? But as those genuine deposits keep coming, they begin to add up. That overdrawn balance is shrinking. Remember that quick fix is a mirage. Building and repairing relationships takes time. If you become impatient with his apparent